Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. We have Tina Martini of Deckert LLP and Rich Lenkoff from Downey & Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. We're now in week three of the search for Nancy Guthrie, that 84-year-old mother of NBC Today show host Savannah Guthrie. Over the weekend, we were told about people being detained in the case, a SWAT situation not far from Nancy's Tucson home. Didn't turn out to be anything of great importance. We know that the county sheriff and FBI have been having a little bit of a turf war when it comes to the evidence found, and we know that the reward has increased. TMZ is apparently getting these letters from someone who says they know something, want to share information, but they want Bitcoin in exchange. Dante Mills, owner of Mills Legal in New York, joins us to talk about the case. Dante, thanks so much for coming back on with us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Dante, we really appreciate you being here. We know you're all over the media. You were on CNN last week on this. So Ryan mentioned the video. There's the latest video from Savannah Guthrie, I think, was released over the weekend, yesterday maybe, and she addresses the abductor. She says that it's never too late to do the right thing. In your experience, do public pleas like those move the needle, or can they maybe complicate an already active criminal investigation?
They can't hurt. And you understand the nature of the public plea. Ultimately, there's a lot of people with their eyes on this. This is a top story, but we have to remember that it's a family who's dealing with the matriarch of that family being taken. It's an extremely bizarre situation. So the family is going to do whatever they could possibly do to make a difference. And like I said, it's not going to hurt. They're letting the abductors know that they're still open to negotiating, to talking. I know there hasn't been in a direct line of communication. So you have to get out into the public and make that plea whenever you can, however you can, and hope that in exchange for that, that they recognize that there's still a possibility there for them to get something out of this, that part isn't over, because that truly may be the only reason they return her, if they can get something in exchange.
So Dante, investigators recovered a glove with DNA about 2 miles from the home that appears consistent with one worn by a person who was seen on doorbell footage the morning she disappeared. What's the next step with that evidence?
There's a lot going on with the evidence in this case. If we recall, initially when the investigators went to the home, you assume they did a thorough search of the home. They marked items. They did an inventory of things. They collected whatever they could, which would have included any DNA from the scene. I understand that there were 3 or 4 different samples that they took, including the housekeeper and other people. But when you combine that now with something that was found off-site, they did run DNA testing on that. And what you can do from that is you can determine if the DNA in that glove matched any of the DNA in the house. If those things are matched, then you say, okay, this was the glove worn by the perpetrator. Whoever wore this glove was inside the house. It looks similar to the glove that we saw on the video that was put out of the perpetrator coming in that or approaching that front door. So what they can then say is this is the same glove. It seems kind of sloppy, though, that something like this crime that was committed, that they would just drive a little bit away from the scene, 2 miles. You figure that takes, 2 or 3 minutes, and then throw the glove out of the window. I don't know how probable that is or likely that is. It seems a bit sloppy, but it's a big break if they find it. There is a second component to that, though. Just because you have someone's DNA, I don't want people to assume that that means the case is broken or they cracked the case, because you have to then match that DNA with the person. We don't have a national database with everybody in this country's DNA. We do have, if you were arrested recently in the recent years when they start collecting DNA samples after arrest, or if you voluntarily submitted your DNA, which some people do, but I'm sure if you have a plan of committing crimes, or you're that kind of person, you're not voluntarily just submitting your DNA to any database, but you have to hope that the DNA that was found, if it matches DNA in the house, or even if they're able to pull that DNA from the glove They can identify a person with it. That way they can rule out that person or have a line to that suspect. But it won't be easy just linking that because you have to get that hit. And sometimes that's magic, right? Trying to find the one person whose DNA is on that glove in some kind of database that's already stored. And you're talking about, you know, a national database or things that's not centralized where everybody's records are in the same place. So it makes it difficult. There's another component to that, though, that I just want to bring up quickly. We also know that they released and opened up that crime scene after they did their initial investigation. They got that letter and then they closed it back off and went back in. But in the meantime, what was happening in that house? Did anybody enter that house? I mean, we saw bizarre things like a pizza guy just walk up to the front door. So the concern there is the scene itself, if it was preserved, if you can say that all of the DNA that's found in that scene, let's say they went back that second time and found another sample of DNA. Can you say that the chain of custody was there to show that that DNA was there from the beginning? If I'm the defense attorney on this, if there's a second investigation into that house after they open it back up and that's where they found the match, I'm questioning the chain of custody. And I'm saying they can't show that somebody didn't go back into that house and place the DNA there because it wasn't there. They didn't pick it up the first time they did that investigation. And that's kind of been what's been happening here. There's been a rush to get justice, to find someone. And there's been some holes or some I's that haven't been dotted and some T's that haven't been crossed, that if this case does come to fruition, if they find somebody, they try and get a conviction, it may be hard to do so because of those technical loopholes.
Dante, the video that we've all now seen all over the media of the door camera shows a suspect. The FBI has described him as 5'9 to 5'10 with a medium build. The backpack that he is seen carrying is a house brand at Walmart, literally thousands sold all over the country, perhaps all over the world. What can the FBI, what can authorities do with that information, given that it's so generic?
Everything. I understand the backpack is generic, and I don't think that's by accident. They're not going to get a fancy backpack or something exclusive. If you're going to do a crime, the understanding or belief is that they're going to dispose of that backpack right after, so they're not going to spend a lot of money on it. They're going to grab something that's very common. But I don't want to minimize the impact of having that video. We knew that she did not have the subscription where it records. So there was a belief that they would not be able to find anything, but it's a Nest system, which means that all of those recordings kind of go into one trash dump after the video is taken, and they were able to retrieve some of that video essentially from the trash before it was recorded over, before that trash bin was deleted. And that's very significant because we have to understand how people think. This happens all of the time in my cases. When a witness comes in, the things that they recall from other individuals is very peculiar. You know, a witness can come in and just say, I saw the way this person's hand moved or this person's eyes look familiar. The things they can identify, they're very individual. So having that video, it really does speed up the process of this investigation. I know that a lot of tips have come in, about 30,000 in climbing now. But people recognize things from individuals about how they walk, their gait, how they move their arms. The guy turned around a couple of times, and it could just be somebody, a neighbor, an ex or something like that, that's like, no, I recognize that movement. And that's really how a lot of these cases break open. And you would think, oh, that video is just a couple of seconds long. He had a mask on. How can anybody recognize him? But that's absolutely not the case. We know that people recognize individual things about other people in a way that it's hard to explain. I mean, I can recognize my wife's, her hand. The way she holds her hand, it just sticks out to me. That's something that comes to mind that just sticks out to me. If I see her hand anywhere, right, a piece of it, I would know it. And that's how specific these things are. So I think that's a major break in this case. And you hope that when you add the details like the height that they were able to get by looking at the shadow formations and things like that, when you talk about the backpack he was wearing, the jacket he was wearing, the gloves he was wearing that may in fact match that glove that they found off site, all of those things are key pieces that you can put together in this puzzle to try and get a good picture. And hopefully somebody does recognize, you know, the way he moved his head or the way he moved his shoulders when he lifted up the flower or something like that, and make that tip and allow this case to be broken.
So, Dante, as you mentioned, the FBI is combing through many, many thousands of tips. And, you know, I think we all suspect that at least to a certain extent, that's because they've doubled the reward to $100,000. And I'm sure that the number of tips they've gotten spiked pretty dramatically as that reward continues to go up. Do rewards like this actually generate usable evidence? As you just profiled, things like a video, no matter how short, can actually be extraordinarily helpful, especially if people are able to identify that person. But given the types of tips that the FBI is getting and the volume, do these generate usable evidence or just generate more noise for investigators to have to sort through?
Both. That's the short answer. Some of the tips are going to be, I had a dream last night that this person did it. And obviously you discount that, and it's hard to take that credible. But some may lead to something significant, and you never know which tip is going to do it. It's a very tedious process. I've been involved in that process, and the tips that come in, because it's such a wide range, you have to at least look at each one, because you don't want to just discount somebody who says, oh, I recognize the way he moves his shoulders. And you're thinking, as I just said, oh, that can't be. But in fact, they do. Right. So you have to follow up. There's often teams that are assigned to tips. And again, it's very tedious. They are using programs now to get rid of a lot of the bizarre tips, like I had a premonition, those kind of things. So you can shorten the amount of tips, the list that you have to go through. But they're going to follow up on those tips. And we saw them follow up on a tip last week where they did that traffic stop, which meant they got a tip and that person was mentioned. They began to investigate that person. They saw him driving essentially towards the border. He was about 9 miles from the border where they investigated him. So they didn't know if he was trying to leave the country. And they turned it into a traffic stop because they didn't have a warrant for his arrest at that time. They didn't have enough information to get a warrant for his arrest. So they did a traffic stop, which then led to them being able to investigate. I'm not a big fan of the police officers doing that. I think that's a way around the law and the protections that we have. You can't just wait for somebody to do a rolling stop or hope that they don't turn on their turn signal so that you can pull them over and essentially detain them without having the probable cause or the right to do so. But that's, you know, essentially what happened in this case. They're going to follow up on these tips and hope that one leads to that information. And we have to believe that the more people that call in, the more likely you are to hit the right one. But that also means the more people that call in, the more bad tips that you have to sift through to get to that right tip. But they have to keep doing it, because as of right now, that's their only hope. They don't have really anything else to go off of.
Okay, I want to wrap up by asking you a two-part question. It's not an easy one, but, you know, this has gotten literally wall-to-wall coverage in all media for many weeks, going on, 4 weeks, lead story on the news, breaking into the Olympics, nonstop coverage. You know, we understand the fascination with it, I think. This is a celebrity mother. Abductions of women in their 80s is pretty rare. I'm looking at some FBI crime statistics. That's pretty rare. That being said, you know, more than 500,000 people go missing in the U.S. every year. None of them get this kind of attention. So number one question to you is this a case of missing white woman syndrome? Many women, you know, the minority population, especially with women, are disproportionately represented in abductions vis-a-vis their overall population. Why aren't those cases getting the daily nonstop media attention that this one gets, number one? Number two, does the media attention that this is getting, can that also hurt efforts to recover her? Talk to us about those two issues, please.
Sure. Let's start with the second one. I don't know if the media attention that this is getting can necessarily hurt it, other than copycats popping up or people sending in ransom notes who may not be associated with this. We know that that's already happened, that they found someone who sent in a note that, in fact, when they investigated that note, it linked back to someone who had nothing to do with this crime. So you can open up expose this to frauds from the outside, trying to capitalize on this crime. But the crime itself getting the national attention, it kind of snowballed. One, we're talking about someone who is in the news. She's in the media. She's on television every day in people's homes and on their TV screen. And she's a beloved person. So it was going to be a top story because she had to go back in front of the media or be on that news station the next day. And obviously wasn't able to do that because her mom was abducted. So it became a national story. Once it becomes a national story, I think we have to put all of the attention behind it to solve this crime. I know that too many girls go missing or abducted of all ages, of all races. And we do need to focus on them all. But practically speaking, resources are finite. That's just impossible. We would love to, every single time someone is abducted, to have this kind of attention, to have pictures out there, to have stories, to have tip lines, to have $100,000 rewards. But it's just not feasible. It's not possible. So why is this one important? It's because when you have a national story, you want to solve that crime because you want to make people at least believe that if something happens to them, you can find out who it is. You can bring them to justice. You don't want to have these public crimes go unpunished because that's not good for deterrence. Deterrence is a major portion of the law. And once this became a big story, I think it has to be. You have to kind of walk this all the way through because there's people sitting there thinking, man, if this famous person's mother is taken and there's nothing they can do about it, imagine if something happens to me or my daughter or my mom. There's no chance, right? And you don't want the United States, the people in this country, to have that impression that things can happen and people can get away with it. So yes, it became a hot story because she's in the news every day, and her friends in the news and the media wanted to talk about it and bring attention to it. But now that it is, I think it's important for people to get behind it, to call in tips if you know. Even those who are sad thinking, you know, my child was abducted and nobody really is doing anything. I don't want them to feel like this is them versus me kind of a situation. You want these national stories to be solved. So other copycats don't pop up and say, well, I can get away with this because they did. Let me do it too. And you want the people to feel safe. So I think it's important, this story, not because it's an older white woman, but because, you know, the country knows about it. And we want to solve crimes that are in the spotlight to give people that peace of mind.
And I can tell you, because of this case, we in the media are getting a refresher on suspect versus subject and detained versus arrested. So, Dante Mills, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Uber has been ordered to pay a woman $8.5 million after she says she was raped by a driver in Arizona. Deepak Gupta is the founding principal of Gupta Wessler LLP and a lecturer at Harvard Law School, where he teaches the Harvard Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. He's here on Legal Face-Off to talk to us about this case. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Deepak, tell us a little bit more about this case. I mean, it's being seen as a pretty important case, given that it's against the backdrop of thousands of similar cases that have been filed. And can you also explain what Gupta Wessler's role is in this litigation?
Yeah, sure. It is a really important case because, as you mentioned, there have been thousands of cases filed against Uber by sexual assault survivors and rape survivors. And they've all been put into what's called a multi-district litigation, which is a giant proceeding where the federal courts try to deal with this issue, where really similar claims have been filed all over the country. And one reason this trial is so important is it's what's called a bellwether. It's the first case that actually went to trial in that entire multi-district litigation. And so it sets the tone of what happens next in this sort of epic legal fight between Uber and the survivors. Now, we didn't try this case. Our role is we represent a group called the Consumer Attorneys of California, which is the group that represents all of the trial lawyers across California. And Uber is in a fight with that group because Uber is trying, at the same time that it's fending off this litigation, it's also supporting ballot initiatives in California and elsewhere to try to change the law to make it harder for ordinary people to hold companies like Uber accountable. And so the consumer attorneys launched an advertising campaign, a political advertising campaign about Uber's sexual assault problem. And then in the multi-district litigation, Uber actually asked this federal judge, the same federal judge overseeing the trial, to issue an order halting that political advertising campaign. We came in to assert the First Amendment rights of the attorneys and to ask the judge to stop that request, which he did.
So Deepak, why was this a bellwether case? This was a three-week jury trial in Arizona. This passenger said that, as Tina mentioned, she was sexually assaulted by one of Uber's drivers. Really the first case that went to trial of this, and there's, what, 3,100 other similar lawsuits that are consolidated. So tell us why this is a bellwether case.
Yeah, well, bellwether is the term that we use for a test case in a multi-district litigation. So the parties agree to choose cases that are going to go first in the queue, so to speak. And, you know, that sets the tone because then there can be an appeal and it sets the law and it's a signal about how the multi-district litigation might go. So it's a big deal that the plaintiff in this case won the very first federal trial. The plaintiff won under a theory called apparent agency, which basically means that the driver is an agent for the company. So, you know, Uber and companies like it, they like to classify these people as independent contractors and argue that, you know, they're not really responsible for their conduct. So by finding that the driver in committing this sexual assault was an agent of the company, the jury kind of cut through those legal fictions and recognized the facts for what they are, which is really these people are controlled by the company. The platform has the ability to do things to prevent sexual assaults. And there's a long history of Uber prioritizing, you know, getting drivers on the roads over screening them and ensuring that women are safe.
So Deepak, so that was one of the defenses that Uber raised, was that these folks are independent contractors. There were also a number of other defenses that they raised during this litigation in order to avoid accountability. Can you walk us through what those were?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a long history about this and a long public controversy. And what Uber says is, look, we're just a platform. We're just a technology. All we do is match up riders and drivers. You know, we don't control what they do. We're just like a matchmaking service, basically. And so there's nothing we can really do to, you know, if there's a criminal act that somebody commits, what they say is that we're not responsible for that. But the truth is that there's a lot that Uber can do. First of all, they are screening these drivers. They know, and they're in a better position than the woman who enters this car to know whether that person has a history of committing sexual assault, whether that person has a criminal record, whether they're on a sex registry. And unfortunately, there have been people who have been found to be Uber drivers where all of those things are the case. It would have been quite easy to screen them out. And, you know, normal taxi companies do that. So there are a lot of places where the rules that apply to traditional normal taxi companies are a lot stricter than the rules that apply to Uber and other rideshare companies, because they have used their lobbying power and economic power to change the rules. That's kind of been true of Uber from the beginning. So there's a real debate about kind of the way the platform is designed and whether there's stuff Uber could do to prevent this from happening, as opposed to it just being a kind of a crime that was committed that Uber had nothing to do with. That's kind of those are the contours of the debate.
Deepak, I know there was this issue about the ad campaign about Uber receiving a report of sexual assault or misconduct every 8 minutes. You won that issue, I know. What happens now with this verdict? Will there be an appeal? I assume there will be, if not already filed. What's happening now?
Yeah, Uber has said it will appeal, and that is pretty much always what happens when you have one of these bellwether cases. And that's kind of the idea, is if you're going to have all these cases, it's not really realistic for the legal system to try all of these cases. And when we're talking about sexual assault or rape, you also have to take into account that it's very difficult for survivors to have to go through a trial. So I think everyone hopes that what will happen is that ultimately there'll be some kind of resolution. And I actually think the fact that the first trial went for the plaintiffs makes it more likely that there will be a global resolution at some point, probably not immediately. Maybe, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens with the appeal. But the hope is that there's a resolution that compensates the survivors, but also hopefully changes the practices going forward, so this doesn't happen to other people in the future.
Yeah, maybe tell us about that if you can. What do you think Uber should do to avoid this from happening again?
Yeah, I mean, that statistic that you cited is really striking. It comes from, you know, New York Times reporting about what Uber knows about what's happening. So if they know that they have this problem, you know, they also, I think the documents show, they know that there are things they can do to prevent the problem. So I've mentioned a few, which is, you know, screening the people who are riding. There are also alert systems that they can put in place to make sure that people can alert the authorities or the police where there are problems. So this isn't rocket science, you know, and we've seen that, as I mentioned, taxi companies have those same kind of safety precautions. The truth is that Uber has to prioritize safety as much as it prioritizes profits. And what they've been doing is trying to just get warm bodies into these, you know, into these vehicles to drive people without taking sufficient account of safety. And so I'm hopeful that this litigation will lead to some real change. And I think this bellwether trial is a really important first step in that direction.
Deepak Gupta, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on WGNradio.com. Dwayne Morris, LLP, has released its Class Action Review 2026, an analysis of more than 1,700 decisions in the past year, examining all categories of class action litigation. And here to talk with us about that is Jerry Mattman Jr., chair of Dwayne Morris' Class Action Defense Group. He brings 4 decades of practice and has defended some of the most significant Bet the Company cases ever filed in corporate America. Thanks so much for joining us, Jerry.
You got it, Ryan. Great to be here.
Sure. It's an honor to have you on. So the review that Ryan referenced shows that the top 10 class action settlements alone in 2025 top $70 billion. That's with a B. That was the highest ever. Is this a one-off spike, or are we entering a new era of exposure for corporate America?
I think we're definitely within that new area. It's all over the last 4 years since the end of COVID-19, where you look at the top 10 settlements across the board in every area where corporate defendants are sued, and we have been over $40 billion per year. You could count on one hand the number of billion-dollar settlements in the prior 2 decades. The only other analog was with the big tobacco settlements around the turn of the century. So basically, when you enter into a mediation, when a plaintiff's lawyer has a press release about a big new class action being filed, they have weight, they have substance, and they're worth lots of money, and the numbers don't lie. The amount of money being paid by corporate America is transformative right now in terms of those analytics.
So, Jerry, you report certification rates north of roughly 2/3 in federal courts. Are courts becoming more plaintiff-friendly, or are defense strategies simply not adapting fast enough?
Great question, Christina. I think class certification is like buying a home. Location, location, location is everything. Every case is different. Every judge is different. But there are certain areas of the country, California, Washington State, New York, New Jersey, where the certification rates are quite high. The damages remedies are very liberal, and corporate defendants get sued more often than not in what we call epicenters. And so the analytics suggests that in essence, 7 out of 10 cases get certified. So plaintiffs are doing a very good job in terms of being able to certify those class actions.
Jerry, the review covers emerging issues like AI, biometric data, website pixels, session replay tools, privacy class actions are exploding. What's the biggest single mistake that companies are making that's fueling this wave?
Well, customer-facing companies that give goods and services via the internet are getting sued like never before in privacy-related actions. And the Achilles heel, or the number one pressure point there, is a failure to upgrade their websites and have click wraps and browse wrapped agreements that talk about consent for consumers to interact with the company. And so they're being sued for gathering data, giving data to third parties, and they're unable to demonstrate that the consumer or the person interacting with them over the wave gave consent to do that. And so that's the number one area where companies are losing. And what we're seeing is many companies haven't updated their websites for 10 years, and it's low-hanging fruit for the plaintiff's bar.
So, Jerry, we're also seeing widening circuit splits on arbitration and procedural issues. Is form shopping becoming the most powerful weapon in the plaintiff's playbook?
I certainly see it anecdotally. In turn, I'm defending cases in about 42 states. And if you're a major company in the United States doing business throughout the United States, you're probably going to get sued in a class action in one of the 10 epicenters. The American Tort Reform Association calls them judicial hellholes, where plaintiff's lawyers are able to take advantage of liberal discovery rules, very plaintiff-friendly certification rules, extended statute of limitations and damages remedies. So for every 100 class actions being filed, probably 85 to 90 of them are in one of those 10 very friendly plaintiffs' epicenters: California, Washington, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois. Those are where the huge concentrations are, where plaintiffs tend to do best.
Jerry, we have a lot of general counsel who listen regularly and watch our podcast. If you are one of these general counsels listening or watching, what's the one area in 2026 that keeps you up at night and why?
Couple of areas. The first area is, how do I pay people and make sure I'm compliant in terms of the way I abide by applicable wage and hour laws throughout the United States? There's not one size fits all, and there are local and state regulations that are much more rigorous than federal law, and that's the number one area where employment law class actions are brought. Another would be my arbitration program. It's the best antidote to class actions to have a class action waiver and arbitration agreement. But last year, the analytics showed that employers only won that 65% of the time, and those programs are not state of the art. So I lose sleep at night to make sure my system is state of the art. And then I think it would be, am I ready for a data breach? Data breaches exploded last year with 1,800 class actions, and the ability of a corporation to safeguard the data, to audit what's going on, and to provide comfort to people whose data has been breached is probably one of the number one pressure points in the class action space right now. Other than that, I think you can sleep soundly.
All right, Jerry Madman, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckert has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckert helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckert, visit Deckert.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Crap Bag. He's back. We didn't scare him away last month. Mitchell Eppner is civil and criminal litigator with Cudman, Trachten, Allo, and Posner. He brings with him 3 decades of experience, including employment, entertainment, securities, intellectual property, trusts, and estates, as well as criminal litigation. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me again.
Another repeat guest, Virginia Peterson, a partner in the Houston office of Mayer LLP, where she leads a respected litigation practice group serving clients across sports and entertainment, recreation, hospitality and retail, transportation and construction industries. Virginia, thank you so much for coming on.
And thank you so much for asking me to be here.
All right, let's start with Trump Watch. But this really has kind of morphed into Kelly versus Hegseth. The judge has blocked the defense secretary's punishment of the Democratic senator over his illegal orders video. Rich, you want to get us going here?
I mean, we've all probably seen the video in question. He was joined by several other lawmakers, all of whom were veterans, all of whom, you know, in so many words, said don't follow illegal orders. That sparked this whole controversy with Trump and Hegseth, who said that he was engaged in seditious behavior because he was telling, you know, active service members to disobey orders. I mean, that's literally the opposite of what they said. Hegseth went, he basically moved to bar Kelly, who is a retired officer. He was a fighter pilot. He's also an astronaut. He was an astronaut. He basically wanted to demote him and strip him of his veteran pension. Mark Kelly filed a lawsuit in federal court. And just a few days ago, the judge slapped down this effort by Hegseth. By the way, the judge, Tina, is a George Bush appointee, so not exactly a liberal. But in a scathing, I think it was like 26 or 29 page order, you know, he used the word horse feathers in describing Hegseth's claim that this was seditious behavior. He said that allowing this kind of demotion and stripping of benefits for a retired veteran violates his First Amendment. And also, he distinguished between the limitations on a service member's free speech rights. As an active service member, you do have your First Amendment rights that are, you know, limited. But the judge said that doesn't apply to veterans like Kelly. And by the way, we should thank veterans like Kelly for their service. And this is not a way to do it in so many words. But it was a really scathing and I think well written and justified decision.
I agree, Rich. There were a lot of exclamation points in that decision. It seemed like every other sentence had an exclamation point. And you know what? I completely agree with where the judge came out on this. I mean, talk about just disrespecting veterans, not just Kelly, but veterans generally. I do agree that this was the right result. This is not a way to get people on board with defending our country if they get treated like this on the back end.
Yeah, Mitch, this is just basically Trump being Trump and the administration trying to bully people who exercise their free speech. I mean, this is a senator. He said nothing, you know, illegal or seditious, or, you know, he basically said that what is in the active military code, which is don't follow legal orders. What are your thoughts on what the judge did? Feel free to disagree, of course.
I not only align myself with what you both said, but I'm going to go further. First, Judge Leon is not just a Bush appointee, up until very recently, he was considered the most doctrinaire conservative on the district court in the District of Columbia. He's a very smart man, and I don't mean to disparage him by saying he was a doctrinaire conservative. He was, you know, a true Federalist Society type who appears to have believed in the things that he was saying, because when the Republican administration now is saying unconstitutional things under his prior views, he's adhered to his prior views rather than aligning himself with the new position that the Republican administration is demanding. Number two, I think Judge Leon makes a really good point in saying that the DOJ was not able to come up with a single instance where any veteran was previously subjected to these sorts of restraints on their First Amendment rights. And as the judge said, he was not going to be the first. And that brought a couple of exclamation points as well. He had double-digit exclamation points in this opinion. And then the third thing that the judge points out is it's not just that these are veterans and squelching their First Amendment rights. There's also a separation of powers problem here, because this is the DOD and Hegseth purporting to be able to sanction members of a co-equal branch for doing their jobs and being able to cause Congress to kowtow to them. You know, I'm just old enough to have come of age, and when I was, you know, going between reading Peanuts and reading the front page, learning about the My Lai massacre and thinking, well, of course we're against William Calley. Well, now we have a president and a DOD who are in favor of the unconstitutional illegal orders and who are against the people who stood up to William Calley and stopped the massacre.
Well said. Virginia, besides all that, legislative speech is protected, right? Article 1, Section 6, Constitution protects, that's the speech and debate clause. It protects speech or debate in either house. You know, it's questionable whether this video is that, but yeah, any other thoughts on what? I mean, also, by the way, it's not a coincidence that Mark Kelly is seen as a potential presidential candidate in 2 years. I don't think that is a coincidence that they went after him.
Absolutely not. And I, you know, it's not to state the obvious here, but it's a pretty slippery slope when you start taking away the free speech rights of retired military. I'm not going to sit here and say I don't understand the limitations on free speech for active military members and how that plays into, you know, them being a specialized community and the way that plays into, you know, cohesiveness and discipline and whatever else you need in that area. But when you are taking away the free speech rights of a retired military member, a well-decorated, well-respected member of the military, it's not exactly great for morale. And, you know, it's actually kind of, to me, not that different from taking away the free speech rights of a private citizen. It doesn't sit right with me.
Let's head across the pond. Nine people have been indicted in a decade-long ticketing scandal at the Louvre in Paris, worth millions of euro. Tina, you threw this into the bag for us.
Yeah, Ryan, we've talked quite a bit over the last few months about the controversy at the Louvre. Let's just leave it at that. And the latest scam is believed to have amounted to a 10 million euro loss for the museum. These folks were arrested following a judicial investigation that was opened by the museum. It was opened after the museum had filed a complaint a little over a year ago. What ended up happening here is there's a belief that there were a number of folks that were involved in this scam that involved reusing tickets, reusing them so much that it involved millions of euros in losses. There appeared to have been a frequent two Chinese tourist guides that frequently appeared at the museum. They were suspected of bringing in groups of Chinese tourists, and the belief was that these tourists were the ones who were fraudulently reusing the same tickets for different visitors. The public prosecutor's office used surveillance and telephone tapping to confirm that there was this repeated reuse of tickets, Rich, with a strategy of splitting the tourist groups in order to avoid paying the various fees that would be triggered and imposed on the guides. There were a number of people involved, including alleged accomplices within the museum, which would probably needed to have happened given the nature of the security at the Louvre. And these folks were paid in cash by the guides in order to help them bypass the ticket controls. This network apparently brought in up to 20 groups of tourists a day over the last 10 years. Rich, we covered back in October the theft of the crown jewels from the Louvre, which obviously drew a ton of attention, with treasures worth an estimated 88 million euros that were stolen. Interestingly, there's a suspected similar ticket fraud at the Chateau de Versailles that the public prosecutor's office is also looking into.
What the F is happening at the Louvre?
I mean, security. Oh my God.
I mean, in addition to that, there was a flood. Did you hear about this? 5 days ago, there's a flood that damaged the ceiling, damaged a painting from 1819, ironically titled The Triumph of French Painting. maybe not a triumph if it was damaged, but the hell's going on at the Louvre? I mean, we know that it's like it's probably the most visited museum in the world. And, you know, there's always scammers, but man, I don't know. Those guys just put a ladder up against the wall and climbed right in broad daylight. Now you have this, like, maybe hire a little more security. Do something. Because Mitch, whatever they're doing is not working.
Well, so this is the first time I'm going to disagree with you, Rich. It's not about hiring more security. It's about hiring security who will actually do the job of being security. I don't know how many people they have there. The French are not famous for staffing leanly in civil service jobs, but this reminds me of before we were on air, we were talking about my Knicks fandom. When I was young, you would go with tickets to the nosebleed seats and you'd slip the usher a 10 and you'd end up sitting near courtside. That's what was going on here. It's nothing more sophisticated than reusing tickets and getting let in the side door by security over and over and over again. Whoever was in charge of security here is either really bad at their job or really corrupt. I don't know which of the two it is.
I wonder how many euro it would take to get involved in that. I don't know. But, all right, let's move on. Rich, Taylor Swift is suing a betting company over her name.
I can't believe we didn't have time to come up with a Taylor Swift title for this story.
I've got them all pulled up. You Belong to Me. We can
I don't
say
want the
name.
Titles. I want something to do with betting, for Christ's sake, right?
Let's see. Look What You Made Me Do.
We are never, ever, ever making this bet again.
Wildest Dreams. I don't know, man. We've burned through most of these with these Taylor Swift stories.
The problem is doing two podcasts in like a week. We're burned out on funny titles. If you guys were here last week, you should have seen the funny titles we had to these stories, but there's only so much a man could do, what people could do. Anyway, our friend Taylor Swift, by the way, I was just looking at a movie called The Swift Effect that like talks about her effect on business and, you know, pop culture. Her effect on our podcast is amazing. She's like maybe the third most litigious person we've covered, which is great news for us. But she filed a trademark opposition, Tina, against a bidding company called Cafe Home. They tried to register the name Swift Home. I don't know if we're able to pull it up, Lisa, but they argue, Taylor argues that the Swift logo, it's like in cursive, proposed by Cafe looks too much like her signature, of course, leading to the inevitable claim that consumers will be confused. We seem to cover these stories every week. What do you think of this one? I mean, is there a potential for consumer confusion over this? I mean, after all, it's the same name. And the signature looks a little similar to me.
Yeah, I mean, we probably cover these, Rich, because I'm a trademark lawyer. I apologize in advance for any of you who are sick and tired of talking trademarks every week with us here on Legal Face Off. But as the trademark lawyer, I can totally see where Taylor Swift is coming from, because first of all, usually when consumers see these sorts of logos, they're not necessarily side by side. So you have to take into account the fact that they're going with what is the commercial impression that they are left with from a logo such as Taylor Swift's. And in my mind, I think they're close enough that there could definitely be a potential for confusion here.
Can I jump in here? Because I too do IP work, trademark and copyright. And I know that you know this, Tina, but for the listeners, there is a difference between a plain language mark or a block mark, which is just the name, which nobody could get for Swift because thousands upon thousands of things are called Swift, and stylized, which is the form in which it shows. And for people who can see this, they're not exactly the same, but they are close enough that somebody might be confused. And part of the reason why Taylor Swift is so litigious in intellectual property right now is she has probably the most valuable brand name in the world right now. I mean, it certainly isn't Tesla.
I think they're highly, highly similar. I mean, I think there is a high degree of confusion between these two logos, just looking at them. I mean, they're both very distinctive. I mean, I'm not a Swiftie by any stretch of the imagination, but I can see where she's coming from on this one.
And Rich, it looks remarkably like the tattoo you've got on your back as well. So be careful. We don't want to see you get hauled in Taylor Swift court as well. All right. There's a battle over who owns the rights to the Ghostface mask in those Scream movies. You may have seen those commercials during the Super Bowl. They've got installment number 7 coming out. Tina, tell us about this story.
So this is a really interesting one, again, from the IP front. There is a lawsuit between Spyglass and Paramount Pictures suing the LA-based special effects studio Alterian Ghost Factory regarding the ownership of Ghostface. The reason is that Alterian Ghost Factory was threatening a copyright infringement litigation ahead of Scream 7's release. And the lawsuit that Spyglass and Paramount Pictures filed was essentially a declaratory judgment, knowing that Alterian Ghost Factory was planning on filing this lawsuit. And the basis for the lawsuit by Spyglass and Paramount Pictures is Scream's been around for decades now, and they claim that Alterian had intentionally slept on their purported rights in the mask by not taking action earlier. This all notwithstanding, a lawyer for Alterian said they were going to be filing the lawsuit anyway. Ghostface appeared many decades ago, and the origins were apparently one of the film's producers found the mask inside of a home that had been scouted for use in the movie. They ran down what they thought was the ownership and licensed those rights from Fun World, which was a costume company that had been manufacturing and selling the mask since the early 1990s. Alterian claims Fun World does not actually have the rights to license, and that's the basis for their claim that Paramount is infringing. In any event, Rich, this is an interesting one just because of the complexities here. There is a history of correspondence between the parties. I do think that the whole Latches statute of limitations issue is a pretty compelling one here, given how much time has elapsed.
Ironically, I mean, the Scream mask Ghostface is based on the Edvard Munch painting, right, of the Scream from the 19th century. So it's like allegedly a copy of a copy. But Virginia, are you a fan of Scream, Ghostface, any of these?
You know, I saw the very first one in the theater with my boyfriend. I don't know if I've seen any of them after that, but it's been a minute. What I think is interesting about this one is, Paramount's assertion that it's really a dispute between Alterian and Fun World. I agree with that. On another note, it's my understanding, just from my very brief research into this topic, that Fun World is alleging that they at one point took that mask and reworked it, essentially turning it into a separate product. Did y'all see something about that anywhere?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what implications that has in terms of the statute of limitations or what freedom they had to be licensing products. But I mean, I think it's certainly a compelling argument. This is a very interesting one.
So, Tina, I suspect I'm saying something that you already know, but the Supreme Court weighed in on the statutes of limitations and laches in the soft IP area. The thing that I find interesting here is from the article that I read, it appears that Alterion brought a prior lawsuit that was itself dismissed for being too late. So they're trying to say, maybe our lawsuit on Scream 6 was too late, but our lawsuit on Scream 7, that's right on time.
Let's go back to
more Trump Watch.
Yeah, we can do that. Let's go back to Trump Watch. President Trump has pardoned five former NFL football players who were previously convicted of drug charges. And Tina, I think the timing's interesting here. He did it a week after the Super Bowl.
Yeah, Ryan. So, you know, this is something that Trump is getting known for. Not that he's the only president who pardons, but there were these five NFL players that had been, convicted of various crimes ranging from perjury to drug trafficking. And the pardons were announced by the person who is known as the White House pardon czar, Alice Marie Johnson, and included ex-NFL players Joe Klecko, Nate Newton, Jamal Lewis, Travis Henry, and the late Billy Cannon. As justification for the pardons, Johnson shared that as football reminds us, excellence is built on grit, grace, and the courage to rise again. So is our nation. And she thanked Trump for his continued commitment to second chances. This is all just really interesting because, as I said before, Trump is getting known for his willingness to pardon. And it's usually, Rich, as we've seen before, folks that he's friends with or where there's something that's in it for him.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's what we call a jock sniffer, right? I mean, he likes to hang out with, really famous people and athletes. And this is an example. And, you know, he's sending ICE to round up farm workers and people on the streets of American cities and killing them and, you know, talking tough about stopping the scourge of drugs and all that stuff. And then, what, three or four of these people that he pardoned are convicted of drug crimes? I mean, Jamal Lewis pleaded guilty. By the way, didn't even plead innocent, pled guilty to a drug deal. Travis Henry, convicted in a coke trafficking conspiracy, cocaine. Nate the Kitchen Newton, convicted of federal drug trafficking charges. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you justify pardoning these people. By the way, they don't have to give an explanation. We don't know, Virginia, any reasons why they did this, much like the rest of the bizarro pardons this president's handed out. But come on, I think he continues to think we're just the stupidest people around.
I mean, it is interesting. Well, maybe it's not that interesting. He hasn't offered any kind of explanation beyond what Alice Johnson has told us, and he doesn't really seem to care what the public's reaction to it is one way or another, right? I have to commend him for his appointment of Alice Johnson in that position. I would argue that the courage to rise again could apply to any street criminal. So it's very interesting that these were the four or five that he chose to pardon, but what can you do? I mean, I don't think he's going to tell us anything else about it. Do you?
No way.
All right. Rich found an Instagram video of a Chicago lawyer celebrating with some clients after a not guilty verdict and some lip syncing and dancing outside of the courthouse at 26th and Cala. It's what we call here in Chicago, the criminal courthouse. Rich, I don't think we can actually play the video, at least the audio of the video.
No, we're not going to play the audio. I think we're going to play the video. No, we might play the video, though. Let's see. I mean, you can't really do the story justice without looking at the video.
Yeah, the problem with the audio is the constant bleeps that would be needed.
Well, that and the IP issues.
That too.
Well, let's see. While Lisa's queuing it up, I believe. This is a attorney who, I mean, to her credit, she won this case. Her name is Sierra Norris, and she is well known on TikTok and Instagram. And she has a long history of posting videos celebrating her victories. You know, I think she concentrates in criminal law. In this particular case that got our attention, her client had been facing, Tina, up to 30 years in prison on aggravated battery shooting charges. He was acquitted. And immediately after the jury returned a not guilty verdict, she expressed her her satisfaction outside the courtroom by dancing to a song. The name of the song, it's a very romantic and it's a very romantic ballad called Bobby Bitch. And some of the lyrics go, I mean, can I say the lyrics? I think I can.
We want you to say the lyrics, Rich. Could you say the lyrics for us? Do it.
Well, by the way, the
family
the
show, like, Rich. Yeah. Be careful.
No, this will be great.
Well, hang on. This song, this was a gun charge, right, that he walked on. And the song begins with two gunshots right in it that are very audible on the song. And some of the words that we hear are, bodies, bitch, make that body flip. You know I don't know karate, bitch. A lot of the use of the word bitch and a lot of talk about revolvers and so forth. So, you know, many online are questioning whether this is appropriate. I mean, you know, especially given the content involved. Nothing wrong with celebrating, Tina. You know, I got a victory last week. I did a little dance in my office, but not, I didn't post it.
You know, Rich, I think there's nothing wrong with celebrating up to a point. I just think, you know, we talk on this show about reputations, right? And I think people need to be really mindful, especially when you're an officer of the court, how you behave in the context of celebrating and how you use things like social media, because you don't want to be seen as unprofessional. And I don't really think that this is the height of professionalism. You know, it's one thing to celebrate, but it's another thing, you know, depending on how you celebrate, it may not really make you or your clients look very good. So that's my two cents.
Well, it's a good point. Mitch, to that point though, you know, if you look at the comments, as I did this morning, they were overwhelmingly in favor of her. They were, you know, praising her. Now, these are, after all, followers. And I think by their nature, followers are probably fans of this attorney. But judging by the reactions, she got a lot of praise. Now, none of those people are presumably the ARDC or the governing body of attorney conduct here in Illinois. Not to say that she's violating anything, but yeah, what are your thoughts on it?
So my thoughts are, number one, not my style, but number two, probably remarkably effective advertising. It reminds me of literally the worst ethically criminal defense attorney in the history of New Jersey, where I used to be a federal prosecutor, was a former federal prosecutor named Paul Bergeron, who's currently serving life for conspiracy to commit murder. And his best form of advertising was that guys who were in cliques and sets would get his face tattooed on them. And not something I'd want, but damn it, if you're a guy who needs a lawyer, you're going to believe the guy who recommends the guy who's tattooed on his shoulder or his back.
There you go. Well said.
The ultimate advertising. Virginia, did you want to chime in here? Did you want Rich to read a little bit more of the lyrics, maybe?
You know, I'm probably going to Google them when we get off.
I have to tell you, somebody who's been at 26th and Cali quite a bit, I'd be trying to hustle out of there because the parking is so expensive down in that area. I don't think I'd have time for
time to dance.
TikTok video, yeah.
I mean, and speaking of hustle, you really do kind of have to respect the hustle with this particular lawyer. I agree with Mitch. You know, I'm going to... I will reserve comment on whether or not I think this is appropriate, mainly because I don't know the facts of the case, you know, that was the subject of the dance. But in terms of building a brand, just in this day and age of social media and, you know, having a strong following, she doesn't care what people think and she's getting clients, clearly. So, like I said, do what you need to do, I guess.
I'm sure the prosecutors and the cops who arrested these people are really appreciative of watching those videos. Let's see what happens. All right, cops, speaking of which, were called to a huge brawl in Florida. People using weapons, some getting smacked in the face. Felony charges are pending. Rich, this was at a country club pickleball court, and everyone there was over 50.
Stop the insanity. You know, I play pickleball regularly, and I will say that it's a little demoralizing when you are losing to people that are well into their 80s. These people have old, you know, old person strength. In this case, as you referenced, this was in Spruce Creek Country Club in a place called Fort Orange, Florida, which sounds lovely. A large altercation, a large fight among 20 people who were playing pickleball. And Tina, I don't know if you play pickleball, but the dispute, I guess, started because of shots in the kitchen. Now, the kitchen is the area right around the net in a pickleball court, and you are forbidden from entering the kitchen. And if you do, you might face the wrath of 60-year-olds, like in this case, who are hitting each other with pickleball paddles.
Pickleball is supposed to be a happy sport. You know, people are supposed to enjoy the exercise they're getting, the camaraderie that they're creating. You know, these are folks that have an anger management issue, apparently, if they're going to be, you know, going at it in the middle of a pickleball game. So I don't know. There's no room for this kind of animosity in a pickleball game.
All right. Virginia, Mitch, are you pickleball people?
You know, I was surprised to read this story. I mean, I play a little pickleball. I'm not very good, but I can't say I've ever really encountered any real aggression. I imagine the country club was not real pleased with the situation. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how recently this happened or if litigation has been initiated against the country club, but I would assume you have some pretty good criminal activity arguments for premises liability. This was a very unfortunate situation, clearly.
Mitch, last word on the pickleball brawl it all.
I'm going back to my childhood, red buttons, advertising Century Village condos down in Florida. When he promised activities and an active lifestyle, I don't think this is what he meant.
Right.
Rich, you ever been yelled at the pickleball court before?
Oh, all the time, every day, every time I play, I'm yelled at because I'm in the kitchen all the time.
I pulled up with my son one time and we had headlights and we left the car and the headlights were still on for like 10 seconds before they shut off. And they literally stopped their game, turned to us and said, "You got to shut those headlights off. They're going to go off in like 5 seconds." Pickleball people, they're a different breed, man. I tell you.
They are different. Well, let's end our show as we always do with a surprise question that makes everyone very uncomfortable and nervous because it's difficult. This is, I'm thinking of a very tough one, Ryan, on this one. Sure. It's going to be the following. So we talked about the pardon power. If you had the pardon power, if you were the U.S. pardon attorney and the president of the United States, and you could pardon one person in the entire history of the world, who would that person be? You could pick anyone to pardon. I think this is a tough one, but let's start with Mitch. I feel like you could probably answer this on the fly.
Yeah, I am going to go with Ethel Rosenberg.
Ah, the famous spy, part of the Rosenberg.
The thing is, she wasn't a spy. What we've learned since then is that Donald Trump's mentor, Roy Cohn, literally convicted her and had her executed in order to try to put leverage on her husband, who was a Soviet spy. This is a woman whose only crime was being a socialist Jew in New York in the 1950s. By that measure, my great-grandmother should have been executed.
Very good. Virginia, do you feel like you have an answer? Someone in history that you feel got a raw deal that you want to remedy today?
I'm not going to take a full pass on this one. I'm going to take a little bit of a pass because I can't really follow Mitch on that. What I will say is, offhand, I can't think of anyone specific I would pardon. I can think of a lot of people I would incarcerate. However,
Give us one of those. No, anyone you want. Because we don't want to defame anyone. All right,
not in this day and age. No.
Ryan, do you feel like you've got someone that you love to throw a pardon to?
I don't know. Can we get people into the Hall of Fame this way?
Absolutely.
Done
of course.
Before?
Trump talked about a pardon for Pete Rose.
Are we ready for Barry Bonds? I mean, he just, like, anytime he stepped into the box, it was going to be a home run. I don't know.
Yeah, right, let's go with Bonds.
I'll go with Barry Bonds. Yeah.
All right. Very good, Tina.
I was going to say Pete Rose, especially in the context of everything that's happened since then. It was so controversial at the time, but that was a long time ago, and we're pardoning people left and right now who've done a lot worse.
There you go. I'm going to keep on the athlete theme. And since we're in the Olympics and as a Canadian, I'm going to go with Ben Johnson. For those of you that, I'm not talking about the Bears coach, Ryan Burrow. Ben Johnson in 1988 won the 100-meter sprint, and he beat the legendary American sprinter Carl Lewis, and he beat him by a lot. The previous record was 9.81. Ben Johnson shattered that with a 9.79. And as a Canadian, I remember where I was when he won the gold. I remember where I was 2 days later when he was being walked through the Korean airport, stripped of the medal, because it was determined that he was doping. By the way, not a shock, because he had blood red eyes and he was jacked up like no sprinter ever. But I would pardon Ben Johnson, because Carl Lewis was kind of an a-hole, let's face it.
Rich, are you going to be rooting for Canada in both the men's and women's hockey tournaments in the Olympics?
Can you ask me a serious question, Ryan? Can you stop wasting our time with very silly questions?
Come on, let's do this right now. Women face off gold medal. Who do you got?
I got Canadian women 4, U.S. women 2.
Canadian women have not, or the U.S. women have not given up more than one goal a game. So
I understand.
Do we have any other Canadian love here on this call? USA, not, USA?
Not for the curling guy.
For the curling guy. All right. Well, thank you so much, Virginia Peterson and Mitch Eppner. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Faceoff on WGN. Special thanks to Dante Mills, owner of Mills Legal, Deepak Gupta of Gupta Wessler LLP, and Jerry Mattman Jr., chair of Duane Morris Class Action Defense Group. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stego, for Tina Martini, Rich Lengoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thank you again for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN. Go USA.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lincoln. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and...